And better late than never, this is WBAI New York, time once again for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. So Billy Bones was the best to say the worst. I hope that's understood. So Billy Bones!
Everybody, the program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Over here.
Rob, yeah. T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Gila.
Greetings and salutations.
And Alex.
Good evening.
How you doing?
Pretty well. How are you guys?
We're doing all right, I think, except for a little rough landing sometimes getting this thing started. But we're underway now. We have an hour on WBAI. We have another hour or so on overtime afterwards. Go to 2600.com, look for the link on top of the page. If you want to just wait online there, you can do that. And we have a special guest coming up in just a couple of minutes. So we have all sorts of things to talk about.
Yeah, well, there's been a lot in the news over the last 24 hours, 28 hours or so. And I think this is definitely going to be an interesting show this evening. That builds on top of a lot of momentum, I think, that has been building this country for quite a while.
Well, we definitely are going to plunge right into that. But I wanted to stop by our mailbox first, because we do get a bunch of mail from people. And we got a particularly interesting letter from a listener who has lived in Australia, doesn't live in Australia currently. Great show, great overtime. A couple of things that you might find interesting. You discussed what would we do if the pandemic happened in the 1960s. How would we do remote schooling, etc.? Well, in my homeland of Australia, remote schooling was the norm for many right up until about 10 years ago. Yeah, it was all done with radio, originally all done on shortwave radio, and it was called the School of the Air. I guess if the kids couldn't get to school back in the 60s, at least Australia could have rolled out radios and expanded the system. So we have an excerpt, actually, from some of the shortwave broadcasts from 1962. This is a combination of what it sounded like and a little bit of a documentary. It's about 3 minutes long.
The Baker Hill Control Station, the Royal Flying Doctor Service, VJC, VJC 3, Baker Hill. It's 10 o'clock. We demand outposts that any medical emergency arising during the school session will receive prompt attention. We cross now to school.
The School of the Air's classroom studio is at Broken Hill, and its four teachers serve nearly 200 children. The youngsters live on 90 station homesteads, scattered in the remote outback, some of them 500 miles away. Many country children have correspondence lessons, but these youngsters have teachers who can speak to them and whom they can answer over the two-way radio. From her empty classroom, headmistress Mrs. Gibb assembles the School of the Air.
Good morning, girls and boys. Good morning, parents and supervisors.
The Department of Education built this classroom studio for £12,000, and the Royal Flying Doctor Service provides a radio network. Let's visit Miss Williams' kindergarten class.
We have written our first sentence. Let's have a look at the kitten in the picture. What do you think the kitten will do? What do you think the kitten will do, Gail? Over to 18 a.m.?
I smell him. I think he'll run away because he's frightened over.
What do you think the puppies will do after the kitten has gone? Let's hear what Gail thinks the puppies are going to do. Over to you, Gail.
I know. I think the puppies will slide and go to bed and go to sleep. Over.
Children who don't see each other or their teacher. Linked by radio. Parted but united, they sing their school song to the music of Murray Cowan's Waltzing Matilda.
Well, who'd like to sing the school song for us? Evan? Well, we'll go over to 8NAN and hear Gail and Christine. Over to you.
8NAN, school song. All the little children scattered through the outback, tune into school of the air at the back, and we sing as we listen to many sad recordings, all joining in though we're many miles apart.
Okay, that is super weird. School of the Air from 1962. How they did it in Australia. What I love about this is all the kids say over when they're done contributing their piece. So yeah, I guess Australia would have made it through the pandemic just fine because they're already doing this. And I also love how every kid seems to have a shortwave rig just ready to go that they can broadcast on. Continuing with this letter. And then note, interesting to note that where I live currently in the UK, they still use unencrypted shortwaves to coordinate rescue helicopters in the highlands of Scotland and the North Sea. And you can listen live. I'm going to give you a link. It's at 5,680 kilohertz if you have a radio. But if you just have the internet, here is a link. It's called WebSDR, WebSDR.EWI.UTWENTE. That's University of Twente in the Netherlands. So it's UTWENTE.NL:8901. Sorry about this. /?tune=5680 USB. Yeah, and if you do that, you will be pre-tuned to the correct frequency, and you can turn up the squelch so it doesn't make any noise, and you'll hear UK rescue, helicopters, all kinds of things in the UK. Thank you, Neil, for that very, very interesting letter. And please, if you have a letter to send us, oth@2600.com is our email address. What do you guys think of that?
That was super cool. Also, it's nice to know we have listeners from, like, the UK and Australia and such. But, yeah, just hearing how they did it, how they adapted, shortwave radios were something that you could get and, I guess, distribute to the families with children that needed them, and then teach them on-air etiquette, like saying over and that sort of thing. It's adorable, and it's very clever and impressive.
I think we should start saying over when we're finished. Don't you agree, Rob? Over?
I don't know. That could lead to, I think that way might lie madness over.
Madness over what? Oh, no, I'm sorry. Over. Yes.
I think I'm over this.
Alex, you look like you have something.
Just wanted to say 10-4.
Okay. Now, this is not CB land. It's very different from that. Okay, and we have another letter from Michael. Is there any donation levels currently available to allow me to upgrade from an annual magazine subscriber to Lifetime? I'm a long-time paper magazine reader subscriber. I'm finally at a point in my life of a small amount of disposable income, and I want to support you guys. Well, Michael, we appreciate that, but on the radio, we're not going to get into how to support 2600. We will tell you how to support WBAI, that is by calling 212-209-2950 or going to the website give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org, and pledge whatever you can. There's all kinds of thank you gifts that the station will give you in return for different amounts. You can have a monthly recurring payment. You will be a part of the WBAI family. You'll be able to vote in important referendums, like one that's coming up next month. And you'll be helping 99.5 FM stay commercial-free in New York City, which is a miracle. We'll talk about miracles and weird things a little bit later on in the show.
And consider that buddy program and stretching what might be a one-time contribution now, stretching that out a little bit, because it may balance out what other members and listeners are not able to give in the future, if at all. So, you know, we may really have, and also that's a really fantastic way to communicate with the listeners about things that are going on at the station in general and elections and so forth. But please explore those opportunities to further participate in the radio station and the broader community here.
Now I'm going to hand things over to Alex to take us into the next segment.
Yeah, well, thank you, Emmanuel. I appreciate it. I think, you know, this was something to which I had alluded to earlier, and coming on the wake of conviction that we saw yesterday of Derek Chauvin, and I think today's guest is going to be particularly well received, because it is really my sincere pleasure to introduce a very special guest this evening, Jason Long. Jason is a Chicago native and a graduate of the Lambda School. Now, Jason and I met a few months ago when he had demoed something to the Human Rights First Technology Advisory Board, of which I'm a member. And what Jason demoed was pretty damned incredible, timely, and I have to say this, unfortunately useful. And what I'm talking about is something by the name of Blue Witness. It's a machine learning system designed by Human Rights First and developed by the Lambda School to scour social media and examine video content with the intention of using high-level analytics to identify nothing short of police using excessive force. Jason led the Blue Witness Project with Human Rights First and the Lambda School, Jason Long. It's our pleasure to have you here, and welcome to Off the Hook.
Thanks, Alex. Glad to be here.
So, Jason, tell us about this Blue Witness Project. I hope I described it accurately. Tell us the history of it and where things stand and how this project came to be. I'm sure, you know, today is probably the most timely day I think it could be to have you on the show.
Yeah, it's really a really interesting journey for this project, and it's kind of funny that it's come full circle today, of all days. The catalyst for this was really the death of George Floyd to begin with, and the renewed conversation that exists around police's interaction with the community, police incidences of excessive force, and police being held accountable for their conduct. So Human Rights First started talks with Lambda School around that time, and the project finally kicked off last August. It's actually, if I'm not mistaken, at this point the longest-running project in the Labs program, which is really cool to see. And, you know, we started with a vision of what do we want to do. We want to be a part of kind of closing this cycle of violence against the citizens of our country. And one of the best ways to do that is to get people informed, let them know just how relevant of a issue this is, and then start to get people talking about, okay, how now that we see how big and how pervasive this is, let's do something about it.
Wow. Now, Jason, this is Emmanuel here. You're the engineering lead of this project, and it's as Alex was describing, capable of looking at video content and identifying excessive force. How does it do that?
So the current model actually is a text-based model using natural language processing. And what it does is we crawl Reddit and Twitter and other social media outlets to look at language patterns that are indicative of police presence, and then we categorize what kind of presence was there. A very interesting project is being worked on by one of my colleagues from Lambda School, Sean Backstrom. He's actually working on a project called SurveyEye, which will be another layer of analysis where it will actually parse and tag different incidents, who's committing what activity, and parse that into a digestible format to help better pick apart these incidents and really understand what's going on. Because a lot of what's really difficult in these situations is, you know, we have the account of the officers involved, we have the account of the observers, and then, you know, human nature, reality lies somewhere in the middle. And it's the real difficulty is trying to find where reality actually is.
Well, yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, without video, there would have been no trial. I think that's certain. And how many other cases have there been where video has told the story? So with regards to Blue Witness, the video a part of this is a project that's still in the works. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, we're constantly looking at how we can gather more information, how we can analyze it better, and how we can present it in meaningful ways. Because a lot of what I feel has been a barrier to action is everything, you know, data studies feel very inapproachable by the average person. And so how can we take this very complex situation and make it digestible by the average person?
So can you tell us something about the text-based aspect to all this? Give us some examples of what you're able to find.
So it's a constantly evolving model. That, like I said, is based off of natural language processing. And the first aspect that we look for is, were police present? And then we use a use of force continuum that is has been established by the National Institute for Justice. And we look at different markers and try to determine what kind of force has been used. For example, level one force on their continuum just means police presence. Totally fine. Police are present at you know, any number of incidents around the world, not a problem. Then we start looking at level two incidents where minor force is used. Someone's been detained up to and including what we consider lethal force, which is the use of a weapon or unreasonable restraint, such as what we saw in the Derek Chauvin case. All of those incidents, once they're classified by the NLP model, are then reviewed by a human just to make sure that we are giving our data the highest level of integrity possible, and then it becomes part of a larger database that is displayed in a number of ways. We have graphical representation on a map. We have categorizations by the category, by time. Pretty much any way we can think of shaping this data and twisting it around, we try to present it in a graphical context that makes sense at a glance.
Yeah, Jason, you know, we all know, I think in this country, and I think the whole world knows, that there is a problem with police using excessive force. I mean, we know it happens every day, but we really just don't know how frequently it does happen around the country. Right? I mean, does it happen 10 times? Does it happen 100 times? So the visualization of this data, the visualization of this problem seems to me like a real innovation, and you're using technology, you're using NLP, natural language processing, to identify where these things are happening, where these terrible uses of excessive force are occurring. And what have you seen? Have you seen any patterns with this visualization? And tell us a little bit more about what the visual aspect of this looks like, because, you know, from what I saw, it was pretty amazing being able to essentially look at a map of the United States and see exactly where there are large problems and where there are small problems when it comes to excessive force, and also seeing that this is not a problem that is in the South. It's not a problem that's in the North. What I could see based on the data from Blue Witness itself was that this is a problem across the United States.
100%. You know, if we look at the heat map of incidents that are in the current database, they touch the 48 contiguous states. We have minimal data about Alaska and Hawaii at this point, but also data in Puerto Rico as well. It involves communities large and small. There's obviously a larger number of incidents in more populated areas. I think that's just a function of more people equal more interactions. Those interactions will be problematic. So in that regard, it really just kind of solidifies that things are assumptions that existed. But some of the conclusions that are being drawn now are really interesting. For example, one of the biggest cities of incidents in our database is Portland. Well, why might that be? Obviously, you know, we all know what took place in Portland last year and all of that. So we're starting to see correlations between events, them being getting brought to the national stage, and then the fallout of that process. Because that's really where a lot of things are happening is, you know, an incident happens, we start talking about it, people start to take action, And then we had these little mini explosions of reactions on both sides, both the civilian and police side. And it's very apparent that when these explosions happen, that things are getting out of hand. And in a lot of ways, the situation is compounding. It's not getting better.
That is, really fascinating, especially to hear about Portland and these cities where, this is exploding. You know, let's talk a little bit about the data component of this too, and the collaborative aspect. You know, where do things stand now with Human Rights First and the project? I got a short update on this earlier today in a meeting with Welton Chang, the CTO of Human Rights First, whom we've also had on the show over the last couple of months. I think at the end of 2020 we had Welton on. And this data, is it going to be available to others to use and to build upon?
Okay. Yeah. So currently, the current team is working on a large focus on data refinement. We were just at a meeting yesterday talking about how we can kind of fill in some of the blanks in our data sets, because when we automate the processing, there's going to be some holes, and we're talking about some ways that we can loop back out and fill those holes. We 100% intend to make that data and keep that data publicly available. In fact, one of the aspects of the project that is available right now is any user can go to the site, they can select a date range, and they can download a CSV version of the database. One of the things that has been very important and central to this project from the beginning is presenting the data in an accurate and unbiased way, really making sure that people can see the full story without a bunch of agenda layered on. And so we made sure that the data set is available for scrutiny, one way or the other, and open for discussion, because this is not a series of events that are just written in history and we move on. This is really an ongoing saga that requires discussion. And, how we handle this will really define our society for generations to come.
I completely agree. And talking about this going forward will be so fascinating and interesting to see as this project evolves and progresses, to see how that data set changes, to see if things are getting better, to see if they're getting worse. And with that in mind, I know we only have a couple more minutes with you, Jason, before you have to peel off, but what about the historical component of this? Obviously, there's a major historical problem with the use of excessive force by the police in this country. Going way back, into the 19th century, what about historical data? Are you able to troll or scour social media and other sources to identify historical instances of police using excessive force as well?
So that is something that we have talked about, and it's a little challenging because, we have conversations around this subject quite often now, far too often, in fact. But as we go further back, information becomes more and more disparate. It wasn't something that was necessarily receiving focus. People weren't posting about it. And so we definitely want to endeavor to circle that in and try to, get as complete a picture as possible. But what I think will be really interesting going forward is to start to tie some of these instances of force being used and looping them back to outcomes. Not just identifying where the oversteps occur, but what's being done about them, and making sure that we're holding our officers and our decision makers in government responsible for the conduct of these officers.
That's such an interesting point because, just a couple of weeks ago, New York City had made transparent its database about, I think, from the CCRB, the Civilian Complaint Review Board, and we talked about this quite a bit on the air in terms of the outcomes of complaints against the police. This is data now that is being made publicly available. Hopefully other municipalities will make that data available so that it can be matched and correlated with your own data set. That, again, seeing the deltas in that are going to be absolutely fascinating. And one thing you mentioned, Jason, which I think was super critical, is that people can go to the site right now and start using it and downloading CSVs or comma separated value files of this particular data. Journalists can do this, judges, lawyers, concerned citizens. So how do they do this? What's the site that they have to go to in order to start using Blue Witness?
So I just want to add a caveat. This is a site currently under production. So, you know, please give some grace to the devs who do really great work if something gets slightly broken. But the site is available at a.humanrightsfirst.dev.
So a.humanrightsfirst.dev using the new gtld.dev. That's great. Yeah, that's where I snagged my screenshot earlier.
Jason, if I could just ask one more question, and forgive me if it's asked before because I'm kind of distracted here, but how did you get into this? What is your technical background, and is there something maybe you could say to people that also have a technical background and an interest in pursuing justice of this sort?
So when I became involved with Blue Witness, way before it even had a name, I was a technical team lead at Lambda School. I was going to be leading a team working on something, and I had no idea what. And the list of projects was put before us, and we got to kind of pick what we were passionate about or interested in. And I saw what this project was going to be about, and I was instantly hooked. I had to be a part of this. You know, a little backstory. I grew up a poor black kid from the south side of Chicago. Most of my interactions with police have not been pleasant. I've seen way worse interactions go on with my friends and family around me. And just to have an opportunity to have the potential of impact was just something I couldn't resist. So that's why I begged and pleaded to get on this project, and I want to thank Welton for keeping me involved in it for as long as he has. But anyone, and you know, I want to say this to anyone who has a technical background or not, if this is a subject that you are passionate about, there are lots of organizations that would love your help, your input, your feedback, your voice. They matter. And so regardless of what skills you feel you do or don't have, if you want to contribute, please reach out to me on Twitter. I know lots of people who are in this space and would love to hear what you have to say.
And what's your Twitter handle?
I can be found at jlong5795.
Okay, great. Jason, thank you so much for everything you're doing. It truly is inspirational, and best of luck.
Thank you.
All right, it's Jason Long, the engineering lead for the project called Blue Witness. Fascinating stuff, Alex, don't you think?
No doubt. And, you know, but what I think is it's almost emotional, I think, to just hear about this today, too, because it's an embodiment of so much. Right? It's an embodiment of what the country went through over the last year, and it truly is the collaborative hacker spirit at work in Project Blue Witness here. Right? I mean, you've got a technical school coming together with a human rights advocacy organization, Human Rights First, putting programmers and advocates together and focusing on a problem that has been a thorn in the side and a notable stain on the human rights tapestry of this country for well over 100 years, using technology and collaboration and sharing that knowledge and that data. Sharing that data is really, really important to combat this problem, to take it down, to measure it, to visualize it, to let people know it's not just in the big cities. It's happening in Kansas. It's happening in Georgia. It's happening all over the place. If you go to a.humanrightsfirst.dev, you'll be able to play around with that visualization map, and it is really, really cool. Cool is a weird word to describe it. It's a cool system to visualize a terrible problem.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head because we always as techies we always like to describe things as cool, even though what it is that we are talking about is definitely not cool and shouldn't have to be a problem in the first place. But if it is a problem, let's have a hacker solution. By the way, we know there were some transmission issues at the station. The full interview can be heard online at WBAI.org or at 2600.com later on when we post the entire show. But that was incredible. That was something amazing. Rob, go ahead.
Yeah, this is a great example of what's known as open source intelligence, or OSINT, or OSINT, however you want to say that. And what that refers to is basically using overt, publicly available sources and gathering the data that's made available there and using it to accomplish your goals. And in this case, we know that a machine cannot yet look at a video of, say, police brutality and judge whether the policeman is using excessive force or what's going on. But the human element of people talking about the video, people discussing the video on social media, on, you know, forums and things like that, and the fact that this can pull that data down, you know, making use of the human element, it's a really interesting and a really good way to apply sort of the hacker mindset and the hacker skills to this problem, and address it in a way that makes it easier for everyone to get the full picture of what's going on. I really have to take my hat off to this project and everyone involved.
Yes, Alex.
The other thing that I think it really bears mentioning, too, and it's a good follow-on from Rob's comment, is that nowhere in Jason's discussion with us did he mention the commercialization of this. It's not about money. This is a project of passion. This is a project of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing it because of what he experienced and what he saw and what he knows his country is going through. He isn't using machine learning and training his algorithms to detect this so that he could make trades faster on exchange-traded funds. There's no monetary value, you know, inherent in this particular type of project. He doesn't plan on selling it to municipalities or journalists. It's out there. And what Jason Long said was, you can go to the site right now and start getting the data from it. I mean, this is an incredibly, I think, fascinating project, and I really think that we should continue to track this in the months and years ahead, because it's something that can make a real measurable difference in this country and hopefully take a chunk of this excessive force out of, just out of commission.
Yeah, and, you know, you don't even have to have a technical background to have a good idea. You know, maybe you can come up with an idea for something that could address a problem or that would be a great service to have, but you have no idea how to actually make it happen. But simply vocalizing that and having the right people hear it, that might be enough, you know, and we need to do that more.
Yeah, and again, to Jason's point that he made towards the end of our discussion was that, look, you know, you have value, and if you want to get involved in these types of projects, you know, reach out to him, reach out to others. There's a lot of people within your orbit that are going to be connected to human rights advocates or other advocacy organizations. There are places where you can connect with others, make a difference. You don't have to be a wizard with Python or any kind of programming language to do it. Sometimes it's just the germ of an idea that can make a real measurable difference in terms of whether a project gets off the ground or not.
I feel we should also mention something else that's happening with our friends over at Distributed Denial of Secrets. Who has info on that? There was a release just very recently. I think it's Chicago-based, right? Rob, did you know something about this? I figured one of you knew something about this.
I do not have it in front of me.
Okay, we discussed it on the list before, so I guess we all have amnesia. In light of the killing of Adam Toledo, Distributed Denial Secrets has released tens of thousands of emails from the Chief Risk Officer, FOIA Officer, Deputy Press Secretary, and Deputy Mayor for Public Safety of the City of Chicago. Twitter, however, is censoring the links, so you can't link to it on Twitter. But if you go to DDoSSecrets.com, you can get more information. And I should point out DDoSSecrets.com. Be careful what you type, because you know, you're tempted to type two S's, one for DDoS and one for secrets. Don't do that. Type one S, DDoSSecrets.com, and that'll get you to the site.
Yeah, or just DDoSSecrets.
Yeah, okay. If you want to say it that way, go ahead. But another great organization of people that are looking for justice and through technology.
Well, and also, you know, we had Distributed Denial of Secrets on the show. I think it was only just a matter of weeks ago, and they were absolutely fantastic guests. And in terms of working against police brutality, you know, and excessive force, or even just excessive funding to certain police departments and whatnot, they were, I think, the prime conduit for the Blue Leaks database, which were essentially exfiltrated data, emails, et cetera, from police departments, and I think most notably fusion centers, which are the hybrids of, or rather the children of intelligence operations together with law enforcement, kind of putting those two things together, which is going to be also known as a fusion center. And so they've been really at the forefront of this as well. So I think it really was I think these two shows, if you're listening to them in a podcast form, I think it would be great to listen to the Distributed Denial of Secrets show that we did a couple of weeks ago and this Blue Witness show, because there's I think, a lot of information on this show between the two of them.
Getting back to the topic of hackers using their unique way of thinking to solve problems, there are so many problems that we're faced with every single day. If you watch the news, you just see all of these issues that keep coming up that never seem to get solved. And we sort of tell ourselves as a nation that there's nothing we can do, that there's no way to fix this. It's just the way it is. And I think that's really, really unhealthy. And I think it's something that we as hackers are positioned to work against, you know, to get past that somehow. Because, you know, we are always, and I mean we as a huge, huge group of people throughout the world, we're always doing things that are considered impossible. You know, and if I limit it to just us, people in this virtual room, well, getting on the air, that's impossible. You know, we've done it, sort of. Getting on a radio station in New York City in the middle of the FM dial, having that radio station in the middle of the FM dial, it all requires a certain spirit of being told something isn't possible and then saying, let's do it anyway. You know, when we wanted to have a conference for the first time back in early 90s, I'd been to conferences overseas, been to a couple in the Netherlands, and obviously the society is different there. Things were easier, it was more open, and everybody told me it was not possible to do it here. You couldn't do it. It wouldn't work. Well, not only did it work, but we did it in the middle of Manhattan, you know, exactly where you would think it would be impossible to do something like that. I think every single project I've been involved in, whether it's, you know, walking in the door of a radio station for the first time, sending out a newsletter for the first time, pursuing a certain line of study that wasn't guaranteed to make me money after I graduated, these are all things that I was told was impossible and I shouldn't do it. And if I had listened to that, then I guess I'd be living a nice, safe life now someplace. But I wouldn't be doing any of this. I wouldn't be talking about any of this. And I just wonder how many other avenues are open to us if we just decide to do it anyway.
Yeah, be careful what you settle for in life. You really should be unreasonable with the world and yourself in as many ways as you can possibly muster.
Well, unreasonable, I mean, I think it's, yeah, I know what you're saying. But it might appear to be unreasonable, but actually it's the most reasonable thing there is, I think, to just plunge into doing something that you think is a good idea. And when you believe it's not a good idea, that's when you stop. But if you believe in yourself, you believe that you might have an answer, don't listen to people that say, can't be done, it's impossible, you're doing it wrong. They don't have your spirit. You've got that. You're the only person that has that. So push ahead. Push ahead and do it anyway. And maybe you'll succeed, maybe you'll fail, but either way you're going to learn, either way you're going to move on to the next thing. Yes, Gila.
No, I agree. I think that there is a tendency certainly now to define impossible as not profitable. And I think the whole concept of so many people are like, oh, you like baking cupcakes? You should open up a cupcake bakery. This whole thing of taking this thing that people love and monetizing it, mm-hmm. and turning it into a side hustle. Like, if you're not making money off of it, it's not worth doing, which I think is completely antithetical to the hacker mindset. And I think also, as Alex pointed out earlier, a very impressive piece of this whole Blue Witness project is that they're not trying to sell it. They just want to get this information out there. It is important. It is crucial. And I think keeping that in mind is a really important piece of it. I think the hacker mindset is do it. Make it happen. Make it happen because it feeds your soul and or your mind or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if we can get away from this societal pressure of it has to make $1 billion or it's not worth doing, I think that's also a really important thing to keep in mind.
Yes, that's exactly it. And you know, if somebody asks you what your business model is, that to me is an immediate turnoff because they're not getting it. They're not getting the point that, you know, you're doing something out of passion. You're doing something to see, as every hacker does, you're doing something to see what happens when you do that. and maybe something amazing will happen, maybe nothing at all will happen. But it's a stepping stone to the next thing that you decide to do. Alex.
Yeah, and bouncing off Gila's, I think, you know, absolutely on the ball point here, which is the part of, I think, the problem here is that we live now in this bubble of social media where there is essentially a digital case system as well, and people are made to feel as if they don't matter, you know, that their voices aren't being heard, either algorithmically or visually, because they may not have a blue check next to their name, right? And this is,
you know, those damn blue checks, I swear to God.
I tell you, you know, it really is. You know, there's a social hierarchy when it comes to this influencer status, right? Being a verified user. There's all kinds of scams that go along with being a verified user as well. But, you know, part of all of this is to make sure that the little people, the non-influencers, the non-verified people are made to feel as if perhaps they don't matter and they're put in their place.
That's us. That everything you just said is directed at us, because not a single one of us, not a single one of the projects that we were involved in has earned that blue check, even though we easily qualified by their own standards. Twitter has decided you're not relevant enough. You're not enough of an influencer. And, you know, we saw this recently in the whole Memphis debacle, where if you said Memphis, for some reason, Twitter banned you. It was some kind of programming error. And the people who had blue checks, they were immune from that. They were considered a little bit higher up. So it's like royalty. And I hate royalty in real life. Why should I embrace it online?
Well, I agree. But part of this, the blue witness system and what they're doing is combating this digital case system in which we're living as well, because they're finding and scouring social media, looking at the actual text that ordinary people, not just the blue checks or the verified users or the influencers, put out on their own accounts. They're looking at all of the texts that are associated with these videos, finding it, categorizing it, archiving it, and amplifying it as well, making sure that that data is heard, making sure that person's voice is heard, that notation of excessive force used by a police officer is memorialized in one way or another forever. And I think, see, this is a way to fight back against that type of case system.
Rob and Gila, you're sitting right next to each other, and I see a hand. I don't know whose hand it is. Oh, it's Rob's hand. Okay. You might want to just spread out a little bit so I can tell you apart. Okay.
Yeah, I'll use the other end. But now the hacker mindset being directed to this sort of thing, another really important aspect of that, and something that I definitely see in the work of our guests today and people like MMS and everyone else whose work we talk about on this program, is it's not just the making it happen, it's not just the implementation. Part of the hacker mindset is seeing how things are. Like I tell people, I'm an activist, I'm also a hacker. I'm not a hacker because I'm an activist. I'm an activist because the hacker part of me sees how things are around me and questions whether things need to be such a way, or whether things can't be improved, whether things can't be made better, whether there might not be a better way of doing things, even if it's out of the, out of the scope of whatever who was writing the manual said. And I think that's a very important part of it, is just keeping your eyes open, keeping your mind open to possibly different ways things could be done, ways they could be improved. Even the very fact that you might be doing something differently than everyone tells you, well, that's the way it's done. That's a huge part of it, and we can't undervalue that part of it.
Yes, well said. And I'm sorry, you don't have to sit on the opposite ends of the couch. Get closer together. I just couldn't tell which one of you was raising a hand there. I want to read something that our friend Voltaire also contributed to this topic on our list. I like the idea of discussing how the hacker mindset can help in these types of situations. The leak that we were discussing before is a type of hacker mindset applied to seemingly intractable social issues. For me, it's important to point out that this isn't a shortcut to route around the hard political social work needed on these issues. They're intractable precisely because the forces lined up against us are so strong, like police, military, corporate profits, etc. It's important that hacktivism distinguish itself from the Silicon Valley-style use of technology to excuse away the need for contentious politics that are antagonistic towards oligarchy, like software vendors claiming that more access to educational software in schools makes up for the disparity in how rich and poor school districts are funded. The one neat trick fallacy is refer to as solutionism, the idea that given the right code, algorithms and robots, technology can solve all of mankind's problems, effectively making life frictionless and trouble-free. And that's something we have to be careful of. We have to avoid that. Thank you, Voltaire, for those words. Well said. And, you know, we're fighting this constant battle inside our own minds, I think, of embracing technology that's really, really cool and becoming enslaved to it and just accepting everything that it does without question. And I've seen people struggle with this. I've struggled with this. I think as hackers, though, we just need to think for ourselves and not worry so much if we get the phrasing exactly right, if we get the ideology exactly right, or if we even get the technology exactly right. You know, in recent weeks, this nation has been roiled by police violence and just the issues, and also gun violence, mass shootings everywhere. And these are two issues that we just seem to keep saying to ourselves, it's never going to change, because either that's just the way it is, or because there's a political party that will stand in the way and prevent you from getting anything done. I'm convinced that somewhere in the hacker mindset is a solution to these problems, because we think outside the box. Like, for instance, gun control or the issue of gun violence. That has to be solved. And if it's not solved, our nation has a terminal disease, because you can't get past this. If you look at the numbers, you look at how much gun violence there is in this country compared to other countries, and it's almost comical how much of an increase it is. And you can have these conversations with people about the Founding Fathers and the Second Amendment and all that, but really, when you get down to it, people are gathering guns because they want to defend themselves against other people who are gathering guns. So, in a way, we can kind of agree that too many guns is the problem. If you can get to that stage, okay, hey, maybe we can work on some kind of a solution that doesn't need these things that we will never get, such as Republicans. We're never going to get them to admit that we need to do something. And instead of every single time on television seeing all the indignation and outrage that never amounts to anything, we need to do something that actually does make a change by using ingenuity. You know, the Second Amendment, and Alex, maybe you can help me with this, it refers to the right to keep and bear arms, correct? And there's that line about the well-regulated militia, which for some reason everyone seems to ignore. But how do you define arms?
Well, of course, yeah, very good question, right? I mean, in the exact phraseology of the Second Amendment is a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Right.
So, yeah, you do have, you know, regulated right at the outset of the Second Amendment as well. But, you know, the meaning of regulated there is also somewhat different than I think what we would ordinarily think regulation means as well. In the 18th century, there were regular armies and irregular armies, and perhaps that's what the founders were mentioning. But
it was a different world. It was a very different world.
That, you know, this idea that the Constitution is frozen in time in the 18th century is itself a legal fiction that I think is risible. It's comical as well. I mean, look, the Constitution and this country have evolved since the 18th century.
Right.
And it has evolved through the use of the common law and judicial decisions. And, you know, what arms are and what arms are not, you know, are definitely, you know, is an issue, I think, that is really at the heart of the Second Amendment.
Well, my point here, and I'm sorry for rushing you, but we are running out of time. A simple, and this is probably completely crazy and silly, but it's just an example of thinking outside the box. Okay, you know, I think we can agree that a rifle is considered an arm, you know, so is a pistol, so is a knife, you know, things like that. But are bullets? Is there anything in the Constitution that says you have the right to bullets? Or how about this? The Constitution defends your right to keep and bear arms, says nothing about firing them. If we make firing a gun a crime every time you fire a gun, Well, maybe that'll make it unpalatable to collect a whole lot of them. If you just want to collect them, hey, I have no problem with people collecting things. I have no problem with people even holding them. And I think most people just have a problem when they start firing them. So if you make that an issue, you kind of do a background around the Constitution there, and maybe you can actually have some common ground with people that agree that firing them is usually bad, unless it's under certain circumstances, and we can have conversations about when that's appropriate. Go ahead, Rob.
One other thing I want to put out there is, you know, the five of us in this virtual room can you know, shoot the breeze about, you know, things that come to mind, but another important part of the hacker mindset is the idea of open source, the idea of collaboration, the idea of we're never going to have all the ideas. And I want to invite our listeners. A lot of you out there consider yourselves part of the hacker community. A lot of you out there don't. But whatever it is, if you're working on a project like this, or if you have an idea for a project like this, or if you have questions about the possibility of a project that you think could make the world better in some way, we want to hear about it. Get in touch with us, oth@2600.com. And we definitely want to hear about what you're doing, what you're working on, or just the ideas you have that maybe we could be looking at something a little differently than the way we are. So, yes, get in touch. We want to hear from you.
My idea was get rid of handguns, specifically with public officials like law enforcement. Maybe, like, you know, set it up so that the first thing, the only thing they reach for is something that's non-lethal, unless it's a situation that needs to be something bigger that's maybe in a patrol car.
See, these are the conversations we need to have. I'm not saying these are the answers. I'm saying this is the dialogue that needs to take place. We are out of time. We'll continue this conversation on Overtime. Go to YouTube. Go to 2600.com. Follow the link there. We'll see you next week. Good night.
Did you read the news? I'm a bit confused. The gun fever is two.